Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Fish and Game Commission meeting of November 2nd. We have a little business to take care of from closed session yesterday, so we are going to take about a 10-minute closed session here first thing this morning, and then we'll be right back to deal with our business of today. So we promise we won't be longer than 10 minutes. Thank you. Welcome you again to the November 2nd meeting of the California Fish and Game Commission. I'd like to make a few introductions to start off our day. To my right is Jim Kellogg, the commissioner from Concord, California. One seat over from me on the left is Michael Sutton, our commissioner from Monterey, California. I'm Cindy Gustafson. I'm vice president of the commission. I live in Tahoe City. And we're missing our president, who has been out of the country, but he'll be returning for our next meeting. So, Richard, if you're tuned in, hello. Good morning. Also to my left, we have John Fisher, our deputy executive director of the Fish and Game Commission. He's sitting in, acting as our executive director today in Joan Carlson's absence. Adriana Shea, also deputy executive director of the commission. Sherry Cole and Sherry Tiemann, two of our analysts, as well as Catherine Pruszynski, our executive assistant. Bill Cunningham, Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General. We also have the Acting Director of the Department, John McCammon, although I don't see him right at the moment, but I'm sure he'll be back with us shortly. And Zonke Mastrup, Deputy Director of Fish and Game. And let's see, who else is out there that I'm not seeing that I need to announce? Our law enforcement officers today are Captain Roy Griffith and Deputy Chief Rob Allen. And I think that's it. I think I've got all the other introductions made. Let's go now to item, we ended yesterday. Let's go ahead and do our report from executive session, and then we'll come back to our items from yesterday. We have a couple items to make up from yesterday.
Okay, with that, Madam Chair and Vice President, Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General and Counsel for the California Fish and Game Commission. I wanted to report that the Commission met in executive session both yesterday and then briefly this morning to continue a matter. We met to discuss matters involving continuing litigation and potential litigation. Those items are identified on our agenda. We also met to discuss two items regarding permits or licenses, and the following action was taken. In the matter of Joseph Robert Jones, the Commission did conclude an order that Mr. Jones be prohibited from hunting in California and that his hunting license be revoked pursuant to cause. And in the matter of Mr. Mark Larkins regarding the revocation or suspension of a California commercial lobster operator permit, the commission did conclude that the commercial lobster operator permit of Mr. Larkins be revoked. The effective date for that revocation will be November 15th, and he will be given 6 days to get his tackle and traps out of the water. That's all the action that I think was taken in executive session, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. We'll resume with some items from yesterday's agenda. Item number 11, do we have a report on that, John?
I believe that we have a written report that was submitted from Mr. Tony Morton. Is there anybody else to testify on federal agencies' informational items? I think we have a written report that was submitted from Mr. Morton, then,
okay.
And I think the commissioners have copies of that.
Great. Then we'll move on to item number 12. Mr. Cunningham again, receipt of legal counsel information items.
Once again, Madam Chair and Vice President, members of the Commission, Bill Cunningham, Deputy Attorney General, and your legal counsel, I have a couple of items for you on informational items. The first one I see, again, a running update on a subject that is near and dear to our heart. So I thought for you today I would also talk a little about honorary badges and the most recent Attorney General opinion, which for the most part concludes we can't have no stinking badges. But I did bring for you today, again, some handouts. that I think will be useful. They include the Attorney General's opinion, which discusses the problems with badges, both formal and informal. I also have a rather humorous article from the Sacramento Bee regarding somebody who was convicted of flashing a fake assembly badge. I guess there are flashings and there are flashings. And then there is also a brief article about our own efforts to comply with the law and our own AG opinion. And then briefly to remind you, let's see, show and tell. I have a official badge that works and that does not interfere with the law. I have another official badge identifying me as legal counsel for the Fish and Game Commission that I think was handed to me by commission staff some years ago that works. And here's my, you'll get a kick out of this, my very official badge that we are now currently surrendering. The Attorney General's office itself also is of the opinion that these are easily mistaken for a peace officer's badge, and our latest opinion is telling us that any badge or badge-like device that can be mistaken subjectively, not objectively, subjectively, as indicating the person is holder of peace officer powers is restricted to those people who are peace officers. The fun part is mine actually even says that it's from the Department of Justice. And I routinely struggle trying to explain to people in various airports and courtrooms where I've gone through a metal detector that, no, I am not a cop. So, but you'll also like the convenient size of this thing. It's slightly smaller than the telephone directory for New York City, not quite the thing that you could average put in your average pocket. But the gist of all of this is going to be that we're going to all be asked to rethink the kinds of badges that have been provided in the past. And my suggestion for all is that in the near future we are going to find ourselves both looking for a different kind of identification for commission members and using something that is slightly different than the current badges. Unfortunately, what that also means is those who hold current badges or those who have had badges in the past who may have lost them will have to work with the department and commission staff to figure out what to do with those badges. Our own office has suggested that they're going to take the badge and mount it on a plaque, laminate it with a nice certificate, and charge me $180. Now, golly, the honor of that just overwhelms me. So, curiously enough, it seems that many people in our office have somehow lost their badges. And those may never be seen again. But I would suggest that something similar be perhaps proposed for the commission members, that badges have historically been something provided to commissioners and do have some traditional value and some memento value. And to the extent that there are already badges issued, we may be able to work out something similar, hopefully for a slightly smaller fee than the $180. But that would be a reasonable way to keep a memento of your service with the California Fish and Game Commission. So again, the gist of the opinion is we're going to have to turn in these kinds of badges. If we need identification, we'll go to some kind of identification tag, and we'll find some rational way to deal with the existing badges in a fashion that will leave commission members with something to remind themselves of their service with the commission. Now I have two other very brief items. At the last meeting, I was asked to look at two different parties who were requesting to have appeal hearings with the commission, and we have yet to schedule either one of them, but I wanted to let you know that we looked at the facts of both. Both of these people did appear in front of the commission and ask for an opportunity to have a hearing. I looked at the matter of the request of Mr. Gentry, who is asking for a sea urchin permit, and his problem is that he has met none of the qualification criteria going back for many years. And in fact, the reason he lost it the very first time and chose not to pursue this was he did not make landing requirements. Now, curiously, we have not had landing requirements for sea urchins for some time now. Mr. Gentry's argument that Well, golly, if we backdate it, then we should allow him to come in without meeting those landing requirements because we don't have them today. But he was required to comply with the law as the law was written at the time, and we cannot change that without changing the regulation. So I cannot find a way to help Mr. Gentry. But we will go ahead, as to the second party, Mr. Licata, we will go ahead and schedule a hearing on Mr. Licata. As you recall, he was asking for a halibut trawl permit. I'm, again, uncertain whether we can help Mr. Licata out, but it's at least worth listening to his arguments and listening to his facts. So we'll go ahead and schedule a hearing for Mr. Licata. And then that's all I have today. I do have one brief personal statement, which I have not provided previously to the commission, so I'll make it official. As of tomorrow morning, my wife of 20 years is heading to Oregon permanently, and I will be following her in a couple of months. So I am looking forward to retiring here probably at the end of the year. Now, I haven't told anybody else officially, so you will be the first to hear these words. And I don't necessarily think, at least at present, I am suggesting I will sever all connections with the commission. Unfortunately, as you may have heard me talk about in the past, our office has devoted much of its time and its labors to working with other issues and other clients, and I actually do not have a backup currently to work with this commission and provide you continuing service. So I am asking and working with my office trying to find a way in which I can continue as a retired annuitant for a period of time to provide some kind of more seamless transition than saying goodbye and good luck. So I will be working with commission staff as well as we continue to work this out. And I hope to provide uninterrupted and seamless service from our office to this commission for the near and the far future.
Bill, as you know, I'm hard of hearing, and I didn't understand what you said about Francisco.
Oh,
could you repeat that?
We're going to go ahead, and while I'm not sure that I agree with all of his arguments about his entitlement to a halibut trawl permit, we are going to go ahead and schedule him for a hearing and listen to all of those arguments. And we'll give him his day before the commission to resolve it. There is the problem he has, as you recall, is he fished for many years in the halibut fishery and then for a variety of reasons lost the vessel upon which he fished. He did then continue to fish on another vessel but did not own that vessel. So he has many, many thousands of pounds of landings. But the halibut trawl permit is a vessel-based permit. And during the qualification period that was given to us by the legislature for qualifying for a halibut trawl permit, Mr. Licata, unfortunately, was not fishing his own vessel and therefore did not have a vessel that he owned or possessed make the landing requirements. So he does not currently have a halibut trawl permit, but we'll take a look at it to see if there's a way he can be grandfathered in.
Okay.
Any other questions, commissioners, for...
Yeah, Bill. Just along those lines, I'm sorry. We have tentatively scheduled November 20th for a hearing for Mr. Licata. We wanted to make sure that that's the direction the commission wants us to go in scheduling this hearing, so we made it a tentative scheduling. So,
and my understanding is that's what you would like us
yes.
to do.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
And Mr. Cunningham, so you'll be here for our December meeting.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
And that will be your last meeting after how many years of service to the
commission? I have worked with this commission in two cycles, from about 1990 through about 1994, and again since about late 1999. So quite some time. And it looks like I may still keep working with you, at least in part. Much of the work, as you know, I do with this commission, I do electronically through telephone or emails. And while I love to be here personally, my suggestion to my office is that I can do that as a retired annuitant for at least a significant period of time. Curiously, the flights from where I am going to be in Oregon to here are cheaper than flying from here to San Diego, which is what I'm going to do next week. So we'll see how that works out.
Okay.
But there are no commitments from my office yet on letting me do that. My concern, first, last, and always, is that this client get the best service and the most continuous and uninterrupted service from a legal counsel on your behalf. And
Well, your knowledge and history of so many of these issues is proven invaluable to me as a commissioner since I've joined, and I'm certain the other commissioners feel the same way. So we
I appreciate that.
Hope to keep that continuity and, well, and knowledge and base around.
And that is my concern. This commission comes with many, many specialized, unusual, and sometimes even unique issues. Mm-hmm. And there are not a lot of attorneys in our office. There are probably not a lot of attorneys anywhere in the state who've seen all of the spectrum of issues. I know even I'm always looking for something to help out on a new issue that pops up, I think, almost on a daily basis. So I'm hoping to find and work with and bring somebody else online for you as quickly as possible. I'm not sure my office would let me continue to work uninterrupted for years into the future from the state of Oregon. There is a curious thing about being called a deputy attorney general for the state of California with an Oregon address.
On a lighter note, Bill, do we have to relinquish those belt buckles that are traditionally given to people?
Oh,
I mean, I don't know if I want to.
Well, no. Curiously, in the years that have come and gone, as I got grayer and grayer, I hit that magic place where I was entitled to get one of those magic belt buckles, and I actually chose not to. But the temptation was great. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
We have one public speaker on this item, but before we get to that, I want to take care of a couple of housekeeping items. This is being webcast. There were some technical problems yesterday with the procedures, but anything that was not cast live yesterday will be archived or is archived already. So be aware that this is live streamed now. It's archived. Also, other housekeeping matters. Restrooms are out the door and to your right and to the right. Please turn in speaker cards to our staff, either Ms. Shea or Ms. Prusinski, any one of our staff, please turn in the speaker cards, and you're limited to a total of 10 minutes of public speaking per day. We have one public speaker on this item, Mr. Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Very nice, Mr. Cunningham. You don't need no stinking badges. I take this opportunity to demonstrate the continuing irregularities in the sea urchin fishery and the permit processing. I think that yesterday we saw at the last minute some fiasco going on, being able to circumvent the normal process, and the sea urchin divers all of a sudden got a few things that they wanted, or the processors did. That was an unusual show of force by the processing part of the fishery, not the fishermen. You did not cater to what the divers were more asking for. These were the buyers of the urchin. Anyway, I just demonstrate that the irregularities in the sea urchin fishery regulations. You say we don't have a fishing management plan. Maybe the finishing touch isn't on it, or the scientists haven't gotten all the grant money out of it that they need to. But the fishing management plan is the fishing regulations that we are harvesting under at this present time. And they need to be, how did the scientists say, manipulated and massaged better to perform the functions that we want for our management. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Item 13, new business. Do any of the commissioners have any new business they wish to raise, or do the staff? I have one item I'd like to briefly discuss. I know it'll take much process and probably quite a bit of discussion, but I've been considering for some time, actually since I joined the commission, that the name of the commission, Fish and Game, is really not truly reflective of the work we do. And knowing that other states, other groups throughout the, I think almost all the other states, have different types of names than Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service, or various other iterations. But I know it's a very sensitive issue to our hunters, especially not to see those traditions change. So I'd like to send it back to the Altauscher Committee and ask if they would at least run the flag up the flagpole, see what kind of ideas we might come up with for the commission, and bring it back to a future agenda. I certainly think it would better portray what the activities were involved in and the stature of what some of the decision-making ramifications are of this body. As we look to get other people interested in serving on the commission, people to work for the commission, and the issues that we're discussing are far and wide, much beyond just the typical fishing and hunting rules and regs. In fact, most of our time these days is spent on other items. So,
I'd support that 100%. Many, in fact, most other states that I know of have changed the name of their departments and their commissions to natural resources, wildlife resources, that kind of thing, in reflection of the much wider range of duties that you mentioned, Commissioner Gustafson. I don't know what implications this would have for the department, the name of the department, but I suspect they're linked and it would need wider discussion. But I suspect we'd find a lot of support for this among the stakeholder community as well.
Well, I'd certainly like the game groups, the people that would support game remaining in the name to have input on this, because I realize the traditions are very important.
I have a bit of a hard time wanting to change it myself, but I am had conversations with people, and I realize that it might be better for us as a commission to consider that. So, as chair of the Altosser committee, I agree that I'll bring that before the committee and try to open up some dialogue and ideas on what they might suggest as alternative names for this commission.
Okay. Mr. Cunningham, did you have something?
Madam Chair, if I might, once again, it's the unfortunate job of your attorney to always sometimes be the sour note. And I would support such a change as you suggest, with unfortunately the one proviso that currently the California Fish and Game Commission is one of the very few agencies in California in the executive branch constituted through the California Constitution. And to change our name, we would actually have to change the California Constitution through an amendment to the Constitution, which clearly designates us as the California Fish and Game Commission. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean as much as it suggests. The department and its name are created solely through statute. So there could be and continue to be a California Fish and Game Commission that would work closely with the Department of Natural Resources or the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the department could look for a name that more properly reflects the current role of the department as well in the 21st century. Or in the alternative, we can try to get a constitutional change, which may be...
There might be some other things you could clean up in there, Bill, in your spare time once you retire.
I thought I would just draft something up quickly, and it'll take a couple of weeks.
Okay.
I believe we have one public speaker on this item. Mr. Weekland.
Commissioners, Paul Weekland. We know that the institutional memory of the Fish and Game, the Fish and Game Commission, has been terribly eroded and decayed by the purging of the files of all the failures. And let's bring up an instant. My synopsis would be that, like the Veterans Administration, they changed their name, the government entity, to the Veterans Affairs. And that way, that relieves them of the burden of everything that happened before. Get rid of the history. Let's just get rid of all the files that show any failure. This is what's happening here. And I believe that the state employees that are purging these files and destroying these failures and these studies that have gone back many years that no longer exist, because we want to start fresh. We want to start new. Don't look to yesterday. Don't learn from the past. Look to tomorrow. These things are of great burden to us. Why is the institutional memory of the Fish and Game being so terribly eroded? These things are not... what we need. We'll say again that the Fish and Game Commission, the Fish Commission, was established in 1870. I say again, 1870. And you were giving a small and nice mission to protect and promote the resources of California. And then Mike Chrisman came along and changed the mission, changed everything, and now we're going to change the name.
Thank you, Mr. Weekland. Okay, moving on, I think we're at item now 15. Unless we wanted to wrap up, did the department have one more report today, or did you want to wait till later? I think we had the law enforcement report that we delayed till today. Good morning, Commissioners. Nancy Foley, Chief of the Law Enforcement Division. Today, it's all about good news. And what I'd like to do first is introduce one of the captains that's over the Hunter Education Program. And he has a short presentation on the Hunter Education rollout. Captain Griffith.
Good morning, Commissioners. I want to thank you for your time. I have a couple props here I want to bring forward. Well, as many of you are aware, we've been for years now trying to get our hunter numbers up in California. Part of the problem is the infrastructure that gets the hunters ready to enter the field, and that's the hunter education instructor. One of the great privileges I have in my job is supervising 850 of the finest men and lady employees of the Department of Fish and Game, those that volunteer their time and do what they do for the sheer love of hunting and the sport of hunting and passing on that tradition. We have a real shortage of hunter education instructors in California. We've had for years. In the heyday, in the records that I see in the 70s, there was about 1,400 instructors. We're now down to, like I said, about 800. For years, we've relied on the instructor themselves to bring the new instructor into the program and become certified. And it's worked, but we lose two and gain one is kind of the way the numbers have gone over the years. So for the last few years in hunter ed, we've been trying to beef that up and do some recruitment, mostly through California Waterfowl, Ducks Unlimited, Turkey Federation, pretty much preaching to our own, preaching to folks that are already there and going to be an instructor if they were interested anyway. So what we've been wanting to do is take it the next step, which is the recruitment program I'm trying to roll out now, and just wanting to let you folks know about it, get your buy-in and your support, and also get a little bit of attention with the media and the public in general. What we're asking is the poster you see there, which is in Spanish and English, to be put up in each of our department offices, any public place, any place where there's enough transfer of folks in and out to make it worthy, wildlife areas, and certainly all regional offices. And then in conjunction with the poster, we have a new brochure, which you guys all hopefully have a copy of at your desk. It is also in Spanish and English and color-coded to match the poster in blaze orange and catch the public's eye. It answers all the most commonly asked questions about, you know, how can I become an instructor? What does it take to be an instructor? What do you expect of me? What do you, I can get out of it? You know, what's in it for me kind of a thing. In addition to that, there's the, at your desk also is the new instructor orientation DVD. Something else we've done with the program is got all of our training across the board so that it's all in one place. The new instructors can watch this. Whereas before, the state the size of California, it's very difficult to ask someone from Susanville who's volunteering their time to come to Sacramento and be trained to be a hunter ed instructor. So now we know at least at one time they've been exposed to all the do's and don'ts and the good parts about being an instructor. So I'd ask each of you if you've got a half hour sometime to watch it. And I'd encourage each of you if you want to maybe become instructors yourselves after you retire from the commission. It'd be great to have you in the part of the family. Have a look at it or pass it on to a friend and let me know what you think. I've also left some extra copies up here at front if there's anybody in the audience that's thinking about it. I know there are a few hunter instructors in the audience. So if it's something you might even be thinking about doing, grab a copy on your way out and let me know if it's something that interests you. Now just kind of open up to questions real quick if anybody has any questions.
I just want to make a comment. Steve, we are on the internet today. Yeah, just for I just want to encourage people that are listening to this that without the volunteer hunter safety instructors, we have no vehicle to get young people back out in the field and do the hunting and right. Carry on that heritage. So we need all the help we can get. And then I just want to throw a plug for a friend of mine who passed away earlier this year. There's a California waterfowl dinner in Antioch that's in his honor. He's one of the hunter safety instructors, one of the best ones as far as I'm concerned. And he's no longer with us, but the dinner, CWA dinner in Antioch, is on the 10th of November, and it's in his honor. So the people that are listening and are close by there might want to pay tribute to that dinner.
Thank you, Mr. Kellogg. And absolutely, our instructors, all it's strictly federally mandated that their time is all volunteer. And it's time that it puts the wardens in the field. If we didn't have these volunteers doing this, we'd have to find somebody else to do it, and it'd probably be our warden staff, which is already highly overtaxed with their own duties. So it's great. It's a very rewarding program. And all we ask for those watching and listening is just one class a year, their involvement in one class, and it means you can even drop by and team teach rather than having to put on a class entirely by yourself. So. Thank you. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for your work.
Thank you, Captain Griffith. Thank you for your hard work on this.
And just so you'll know, that's Lowell Freigard is who that was. So.
Okay. I'll make sure we take care of that. Thank you, sir.
So thank you for listening to that. One of the things I'd like to do is start giving some presentations by some of the people in the field. At the next commission meeting, we have the opportunity to bring our canine coordinator in. We kicked off our canine program just last week. It's run through the CalTIP program. We're working it off of donations. The CalTIP program actually donated the first dog to the department, and the coordinator's going through the canine protection detection program right now. We were able to utilize some of the funds that came to us through the Quagga Muscle Invasive Species Act, and the dog actually detects quagga mussels in areas that are very hard or difficult to see from just a person walking around the boat. So it's a huge advantage, and it's a great thing, a great tool for public education and outreach. And also, as you know, that most game wardens work by themselves, so it's an opportunity to have another enforcement officer out there as a canine. So that was a good event where we were able to kick that off. We also this week gave 40 conditional job offers to potential new game wardens. We did our physical maintenance test. We did oral interviews, then gave conditional job offers. Unfortunately, we lost about 5 in the physical maintenance test and also through the vision test. But we're going forward with everything. That academy will start in February. Also, the other application process for 2009 closes November 9th, and I understand that applications are up, although the candidates that we receive on the other end, we'll take a look at that when we get there. We also had 90 applicants in for a lateral transfer from existing peace officers. Out of those 90, we got 19 that actually met our minimum qualifications, but that's 19 more than we would have had 3 years ago. So they'll also be going through our testing process. And then the reason that we had the enforcement update today instead of yesterday is that we served a search warrant this morning and arrested 5 people that were involved in the illegal take and sales of fish out of the Delta area. It was not only striped bass, but bluegill. Bluegill seems to be a hot fish these days for illegal commercialization. And you wonder why, but anything, like I've said before, anything that's out there is commercialized illegally. If there's a dollar value on it, somebody's going to buy it. And we're pretty certain that these people would have transitioned right into sturgeon when the sturgeon start going up the river. So they're certainly opportunists. We did see some evidence today, boats, cars, things like that. But again, it's another example of the hard work that the game wardens are doing out in the field. This was a strictly uniform detail that they put together, again, realizing that people were out there every single day taking the resource for commercial purposes when we don't have commercial seasons on anything. So good day all around, good week for game wardens and for the resources. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. Great efforts on your staff's part and yourself. Any public comment on this one? This had been from yesterday, I think.
No, I have no public comment on this one.
Okay. So we'll move on now to item number 15. This is receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to the sport fishing regs.
By way of background on this, we're intending to receive public testimony on this date regarding proposed changes to the sport fishing regulations to modify report card structure for abalone, sturgeon, steelhead, and salmon, and to establish a lobster report card. As background, the commission discussed this at the August meeting. The department presented a proposal to revamp the report card and tagging requirements. The commission received another update on this at the October meeting. And it's my understanding that a notice of intent to amend the regulations has been published in the notice register. We have from the Department of Fish and Game, I believe, Marcy Uremko to give a brief summary on this.
Good morning, Commissioners. Marcy Uremko with the Department. The only summary I have for you today is just to let you know that we have been receiving public comments, generally quite a bit of support for moving ahead with abalone tag program, and a fair number of questions about the proposal, what it entails. And we're glad to see that the notice has been published and that the information is available on the website for people to review. And so far, like I said, very positive feedback. We are working internally to develop a video production on actually how the abalone tagging portion of this package will roll out, with the goal of providing the public with a very clear process on how to comply with the new regulations and the tagging requirement. And so we'll be working to produce that later this month, and we will give you an update on that at the December adoption hearing.
Thank you, Marcy. Anything else from the department on this? Okay, we have two public speakers on this, Jim Martin, followed by Paul Weakland.
Thank you, Commissioner Gustafson, and all the commissioners. My name is Jim Martin, and I'm the West Coast Regional Director of the Recreational Fishing Alliance. And should I wait or something? I mean, I don't. Okay. We are supportive of the abalone tags. This is going to be a way to get a handle on the gifting problem that we're seeing out in the field. We're already on record for supporting the sturgeon tags for the same reason. We have a depressed population and a high level of poaching going on. There's one issue that we have a problem with on lobster, the lobster punch cards. We believe that we do need better data on lobster. Well, we need some data. And I think what I've been hearing from our members is that the provision that they're going to have to fill out the location every time they jump in and out of the water when diving for lobsters is going to be a problem. And so I don't think that there's time. I know you're going to have to renotice to get that changed, and maybe we can do some cleanup later on down the line on that. But I think get ready for some complaints on that issue. And I wasn't able to attend yesterday because this has been a busy week for me, but if I could, Cindy, if I could talk about the PFMC issues that came up yesterday, even though it's not this agenda item.
You know, Jim, we typically don't allow that. We stay on, and we need to follow the rules for everyone, but you can certainly submit your comments in writing to us.
Okay.
Do you mind doing it that way? You'd prefer
well,
to do it now in public, but
I'm
hearing from my fellow commissioners I need to be tough.
I'm leaving for
it's hard for me to be
the
tough,
council
you know.
Meeting this afternoon.
Okay.
We're going to start on Sunday, so okay.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Paul,
there was another card sent.
Mr. Paul Weakland, followed by Mr. Milo Vukovic.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland, you've heard our apprehensions about the tagging process, and we would like very much for the tagging process to analyze the bear tags and the deer tags, and the failure that those have had to major poaching and commercialization of these species. No one has seen the correlation that you can't hardly manage the bear populations with these new tag systems, and we want this better analyzed. We also are concerned that the information derived from these report cards. My gosh, I hated report cards. Now I'm going to have a report card when I go fishing? My goodness. But the public relations nightmare that you're creating, the fact that no statistically significant information has being derived from these cards, the fact that a lot of the price of these cards is going right back into paying someone to look at them, and we're not getting anything out of it. The value and worth of these report cards are questioned. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weekland.
Good morning. I'm Milo Vukovic, president of Sonoma County Abalone Network, also known as SCAN. At SCAN, we recognized a long time ago, back in 1994, that poaching was going to be the biggest threat to the resource. So we started working with district attorneys and courts to start taking the fines and the violations seriously. Over a lot of years, we've done pretty well and got them to realize that the resource is in jeopardy from this. And we worked with the department for all these years real closely. We've even worked the checkpoints with them and done those things. Some of the things we do at SCAN is we offer a $1,000 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of abalone poachers. The department had a boat out of the water last year. They were $7,500 short of putting new engines on it, and they were going to have to wait till next year to get enough money to get that boat working again. SCAN gave them the $7,500, got that boat back on the water. Recently, we put up $7,000 almost to send the Special Operations Unit to Canada to train with other Special Operations Units. The department wouldn't fund it, and Nancy's people thought it was important. So SCAN put up the money and sent the SOU unit up there. We bought cameras and binoculars for the game wardens to use at the checkpoints and to use in abalone cases and, of course, other cases. So we have a long history of working with the department. We're probably one of the first public-private partnerships before that word got tossed all around here. We were doing it before we knew what that really was. Anyway, on abalone tags, we support abalone tags. You have two options there, and we suggest you go with option two because option one has been a big problem in abalone. When you go to item three there, it tells you what the definition of a vessel is. Well, some law enforcement have determined that a boogie board could be a vessel because you get on it and you paddle it, so it's transportation over water. And a guy sitting on a kayak soaking wet shouldn't have to try to bob around out in the ocean with a paddle in his hand trying to fill out a tag and an ab card. He should be able to hit the beach before he tries to do those things and be on flat ground. So option two is the only thing that makes sense there, and I think the department's going to support that too. So hopefully you'll go with that. Lobsters. In the language, this language is exactly what we had in the abalone fishery, which was nothing but a problem, that your card may be kept within 500 yards on the shore. I think the only person that knew what that meant was a person who wrote it. We think language something like in a vehicle or in another spot within 500 yards of the fishing location would make more sense and cause a lot less problems in the fishery. The big problem we have with this is if we're going to be asked to put in another $525,000 to support the fishery, we think it's only fair that the commission asks the staff to do a cost analysis on the commercial fishery. We all know the problems with 7-Eleven. They're going to have to be brought up to speed at some time, one fishery at a time. We think this is a perfect opportunity for all that to be brought up at one time. They took in $8 million in that fishery last year and paid $69,000 in license fees and some amount of landing taxes. But if it's going to cost $525,000 for our side of the fishery, it's certainly a lot more than that for their side of the fishery. So I think this is a perfect time to put all this together. So we're asking two things of the commission today. One, ask the staff, please, to do a cost analysis of the commercial side of the fishery. And two, when these things come up, to bring them up together. When you increase our fees to $525,000 on top of the $55 million we're already putting in, to increase theirs to meet the requirements of 7-Eleven. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments or questions, response from the department?
I just want to thank him for being constructive and coming up with some very good ideas. And when you approach the commission with a positive attitude like that and being willing to help enforcement in the field like you guys have, you're much more apt to be speaking to open ears, and we appreciate that.
Yeah. Good morning, Commissioners, Madam President. The only thing I'd like to add is, again, on the lobsters, the big issue, as you've been hearing, this approach to properly managing a resource, lobsters are a very valuable fishery. And the big gap here is we don't really know what our sport fishermen are doing. And to do this properly, and as Milo suggested, is we are going to be looking at the whole package of the lobster fishery, both sport and commercial. But a key element of that and a big missing piece is having a clue what the sport fishery is doing. And that's why this report card is so important. It helped us a lot on the abalone fishery. We think it'll provide the same benefits, hopefully, in this case. And this will be adaptive, too. We don't pretend that this may be the end of it, but just getting a handle on who's out there, their fishing activity. A quick comment on reporting location. Part of the key information is where people are fishing. And so we know it's kind of an inconvenience, but I think it'll be very valuable fishermen that both the fishermen will want to know about and us, too, to really manage this fishery.
Thank you, Zonke. Okay, are we ready to move on to item number 16?
Thank you. Item number 16, receipt of public testimony on proposals to amend sections 353 and 475 of Title 14 regarding methods authorized for taking big game and methods to take for non-game birds and non-game mammals. This item includes this is scheduled for receipt of public testimony on these sections of Title 14. We also will have some discussion on implementation of Assembly Bill 821. And I believe that Deputy Director Sonke Mastrup is prepared to provide some department discussion.
Yes, again, good morning, Madam President, Commissioners. You received very recently a memo from us kind of trying to articulate the outcome of the passage of AB 821. And the effect on your current rulemaking effort in regards to the lead big game method of take issue and non-game. So what I'll do is I'll walk through the department's interpretation of what AB 821 will require of us, both the department and the commission, and then try and relate that to where you are with the current rulemakings and give you some suggestions on how we might make sense of this kind of confusing situation. So if there's at any point you have questions or don't follow me, please stop me and I'll try and attempt to clarify. Good point. Thank you, Adriana. There is a copy of this memo in the back for those who are interested and hope also to find clarity. So I'll start out with the Implementation Assembly Bill 821, which goes into effect in January, proposes changes to Title 14, Sections 353 and 475. Specifically, the bill requires the use of non-lead ammunition when taking big game or shooting coyotes with a centerfire rifle or pistol in deer zones A South, excluding several counties, you can read in the memo, and deer zones D7, D8, D9, D10, D11, and D13. It's essentially a version of the historic range of condors. It also requires the commission to establish by regulation a public process to certify the specified non-lead ammunition, and this deadline is by July 1st, 2008, which is consistent with how we do our big game regulations, or they would be starting. It also requires the commission to define by regulation non-lead ammunition by the same deadline, July 1st, 2008. It requires the commission to establish and annually maintain a list of certified non-lead ammunition. And it requires the commission, to the extent that funds are available, and I'll comment on this real quickly. The law specifically states non-state funds. So the commission and department may only use outside funding to fund this program, which is to establish a coupon program to provide affected hunters with non-lead ammunition at no charge or reduced charge. If the coupon program is implemented, which requires the Department of Finance verification that there's some funding, the commission shall issue a series of reports on usage and redemption rates of ammunition coupons. It also requires the commission to issue a series of reports on the levels of lead in California condors that the department would be doing for you. And it also requires the department to notify all affected hunters. Again, the department will report back on each of these items as we move through this process. If you turn over the document on the back page or second page, we will now go over quickly the proposed amendments to 353-475 that are not affected by or preempted by the NAVA bill. In other words, these are parts you still can move forward with that are not technically affected by the bill. The first one is the commission in its current rulemaking package has options that expand, that could expand the use of non-lead beyond what the bill provides. So you still have that authority in your current rulemaking. So you could expand the geographic range in which non-lead ammunition be used. You also have still the option to establish a regulatory definition of projectiles applicable to big game, non-game, and non-game mammals. This, again, was important for clarity for the public. That wasn't required in NAVA, but as you have been hearing, we think it's a good idea. Also, to establish that it's unlawful to possess any projectile containing lead in excess of the amount permitted in a firearm capable of firing projectile while taking big game. This is an enforcement piece. Enforcement feels they really need to make this law enforceable in the field. So this is above and beyond NAVA, but we would argue is still an important piece for enforceability. It also still have the option to establish geographic range in which non-lead ammunition would be required for non-game hunting except coyotes. As I mentioned earlier, the NAVA bill only addresses coyotes of non-game, which leaves all the rest open. So you still have that option to apply to everything else including the coyotes. You also have an option that's still viable in your rulemaking packages to consider whether to exempt wildcat cartridges used by non-game hunters, except coyotes, of course. And finally, you also have the option to consider definition of non-lead ammunition for purposes of non-game birds and mammals, the piece other than coyotes. To ensure consistency among all hunting regulation, the department recommends that the commission reconcile any definition it adopts for purposes of non-game birds and mammals as part of the current proposed rulemaking. Another item I should point out is currently the existing environmental document for your existing rulemakings, both 353 and 475, we do not believe need to be modified or recirculated because all of these ranges are already currently in there. To summarize, we think you can continue with your existing 353 rulemaking. We'll be coming back to you at the December, if you agree, we would be coming back to you at the December meeting with a guide of which decisions we might recommend. For example, since NAVA defines the area, there's no point in the commission, you can't modify it other than expanding it. So we might recommend, for example, no change to you for the area since it's already in code. So we think you can proceed with some decisions in 353 if you choose. You don't need to modify it. For 475, the ISOR dealing with 475, we're going to recommend or ask permission to go renotice because the boundary options you have in the current rulemaking don't match up with the NAVA boundary, and it'd be really bad to have two different condor ranges in the books for non-game and big game. Yes, and that would be an action we'd be looking to you for today, is the permission to renotice 475. And the third piece you'll need to deal with is the cleanup. We'll call it the cleanup ISOR for those pieces of NAVA that aren't in either of the two current rulemakings, but you'll need to do cleanup on. And the most significant of those is the public process for certifying non-lead ammunition. Now, that's a real quick overview. If you have any questions or comments, I'll try and answer them for you. And we would need to go to notice for that cleanup.
Any commissioner questions or comments before we go to the public?
Just a question on the on this coupon program. Who's supposed to raise the money for that if it's not from the state?
Benevolent philanthropists, perhaps. I have no idea.
Come from any.
Isn't it each of the legislators that voted?
Yes, I understood they all agreed to help fund this program.
Right.
What's interesting is, though, we need some indication from Department of Finance of what that source is. So that is the trigger for us starting a program, is a memo or direction from Department of Finance for that funding source.
I think an important point here in terms of your next steps is, I'll double check with our council, of course, but my understanding is until that funding source is identified and verified, there's no need for the commission to take any regulatory action on establishing the program. So I don't think we need to, at this point, unless somebody steps forward today with a big wad of cash, I think that's something you can
work on. I know I made light of it, but I really do. I think that the model that we heard from Arizona was one that I think we, as a commission, supported in concept and wanted to see what we could work out. But, again, we have to look to our partners to come up with some ideas on funding.
I mean, I'd love to hear from stakeholders today about this because I mean, in the other states, this sort of program was used in large part to encourage voluntary compliance with use of non-nut ammunition. Mm-hmm. Here you have a statutory mandate, and yet the statute encourages a coupon program. I'm curious whether anybody wants to step forward with the money.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear about that today.
Any other questions, comments by staff?
Well, I wanted to emphasize what your options are as far as action today and what you can look forward to in the future. Today, staff is asking for your permission, if you so choose, to re-notice to include the geographic range for non-game mammals and birds, which was what you originally anticipated and chose to do in your original rulemaking package. We just need to make sure everything's copacetic mm-hmm. with the NAVA bill. So we would ask for that action today. So that you could adopt all of this in December, at your December meeting.
Okay. Any other questions or comments, commissioners? Otherwise, we'll take public testimony now. Or did you?
I'm going to wait till we hear public testimony before I make any comments. It'll be interesting, like Commissioner Sutton said, to see how much volunteer contributions we're going to hear about today. To implement, especially from the people who were actually behind the sponsorship of this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have four public speakers on this, and as with past items, you will be allotted 3 minutes for speaking. So when we call your name, please get ready. Commissioners, I want to call your attention to two letters that were also delivered to you in your handouts, one from the American Bird Conservancy and the second one from Mr. Jerry Sepulveda. Both of these letters are dealing with this item. So after I've called your attention to that, we'll go to public speakers. And we have Mr. Walt Mansell, followed by Mr. Gary Langham, followed by Pamela Flick.
Good morning, commissioners, department staff. Walt Mansell representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. It seems like hopefully we'll be coming to the end of this process in a few more months of some sort. The NAVA bill is now law. How to make it work? We suggest, one, let the law stand as it was signed. Do not attempt to add additional provisions such as coverage for ground squirrels and non-game birds or coverage for muzzle-loading firearms. Assemblyman Nava and his supporters have decreed these latter are not a problem. The governor has decreed these are not a problem. We respectfully suggest you do likewise and adopt this position. Number two, certify the Barnes Copper and Nosler E-Bullets as non-lead. This is, after all, what the Condorites have pushed for on all fronts. We do not see how they can maintain any credibility if they say otherwise now. I don't believe they're going to. Lead traces, if any, in these bullets are very minute and are well locked in with the primary metals of the bullet. Number three, adopt enforcement policies either the department or the commission as is appropriate, that allow hand loads. Hand loading or reloading is the only way that thousands and thousands of firearms can be salvaged for hunting. And it's especially important now that the geographic area is much larger than what perhaps the commission would have adopted had they continued on this front. They can save many, many cartridges that are not going to be produced for non-lead ammunition now or in the future. This will also cover the question on wildcat cartridges. There is some misconception perhaps on wildcat cartridges. I guess I could take the point of being somewhat of an expert on this field. I own several firearms that are chambered in wildcat cartridges. A wildcat cartridge changes the cartridge case, either the diameter of the neck or the shape of the case, the length or some other aspect of case design or shape, but it does not change the bore diameter of the firearm. All of the standard bullet diameters that are available from people like Barnes are available to fit wildcat cartridges just the same as they would fit any other cartridge. So the wildcat cartridge shooter can hand load the Barnes bullet in whatever cartridge he has at any reasonable bore diameter from 20 caliber to 416 or 450 caliber. There are bullets available. Number four, I have not had a chance to talk with Chief Foley about this, but we would be happy to work with her and the department and the enforcement branch to develop an educational package for the game wardens that we could introduce at squad level training for either lieutenant and captain squads or at department's advanced officer training about projectile identification with samples of all the different copper or non-lead bullets. There are currently just two. Winchester has one which might be qualifying, does have some lead in it. And we'd be happy to go to wherever they would be required in the area where the wardens are going to be affected and help put on this this training for them. I think we're qualified to do that, and I think there is some hope that there would be some reasonable bullet identification possible. Some aspects are going to be extremely difficult, but in some other areas, probably the majority of the big game cartridges being used, it's not altogether impossible to come up with something that would be at least a workable guideline for the field wardens. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Walt.
Mr. Gary Langham, followed by Ms. Pamela Flick, followed by Jerry Steidem.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Gary Langham, and I'm Director of Bird Conservation for Audubon, California. And today I speak on behalf of Audubon, California's nearly 60,000 members to support a definition of non-lead ammunition that balances support for hunting traditions with the need to protect California condors and other wildlife from toxic metals. We recommend that the Commission define non-lead and non-toxic projectiles as containing less than 0.5% lead by weight and begin a process to study the impacts of trace lead and other metals on condors and other wildlife. And we would also encourage the Commission to include non-game birds and mammals as described under Section 475. As I understand it, the current substitutes for non-lead projectiles tend to be 100% copper or a mix of 95% copper and 5% zinc. In an effort to support a cheaper cost for this ammunition, we're suggesting a very modest standard to help manufacturers make ammunition as inexpensively as possible. The Barnes ammunition, for example, we understand has an extremely low lead content of 0.0005%, very trace. And that's in part because they use a very high grade of copper, which almost necessarily has to raise the price. adopting a standard of less than 0.5% lead by weight should reduce the cost and ensure that all manufacturers can make a non-lead projectile. Part of the reason for this is, as I understand it, the lead content in the highest available grade copper that a manufacturer could buy, so-called tough pitch copper, is 0.4% lead. And so a standard like this would really make it impossible to make a 100% copper projectile and not meet the standard. Audubon has always believed that big game hunting is critical to the continued recovery of the California condor, and we remain committed to finding creative solutions that preserve hunting traditions and protecting the wildlife of California. In terms of the coupon program that you mentioned, Commissioner Sutton, we would certainly be interested in talking with partners and staff about that further, particularly to get an estimate of how much that might cost. I also wonder if in our ability to sort of adopt a very reasonable standard, whether that would bring the cost down, because really a coupon program, at best even under voluntary situations, is mainly to defray the cost differential. So my understanding right now, and this is very preliminary, is that a 0.5% lead standard would not impact condors significantly. Thank you very much.
Gary, just a quick couple questions. I believe, and this is my memory serves, that the calculations I've seen previously is that a coupon program would cost on the order of about $200,000 a year, at least in the first year. That's don't quote me on that, but that's on the order of it. We have a letter here from Dr. Fry at the American Bird Conservancy recommending a 1% lead content as the maximum allowable. Is that, you've said 0.5%?
This is all very preliminary. As you can imagine, it's been difficult to get data on this trace lead, and we actually hope to get some more information from the department itself on this. Late yesterday, I received that same information from Dr. Fry, and it would be important to look at that, in part because the current standards for steel shot, as I understand them, are less than 1%. But, you know, when you think of the current Barnes bullets as being 0.0005, I mean, 20,000% different or something, our main point is we want to adopt some very reasonable standard that helps with the intent of the law without adding any undue burden to manufacturers or to the hunting community.
I think that's it. Yeah, thank you.
No other questions? Okay. Before our next speaker, just let me point out two things. One, I believe a copy of the department's memo on this subject is available, and Dr. Loft is in the audience here, and he can provide you with a copy of that department's memo if you don't have one already. And then number two, the department's environmental document on this is out, and we put a bunch of them out there on the table, and I believe they've all been taken. And so if you did not get one of those documents, please contact the Department of Fish and Game if you're getting this by webcast. If you're here in this building and you want to get a copy of that document, please contact Dr. Loft, and I think he can help you to get one of those. Okay, so now we have Pamela Flick with Defenders of Wildlife, followed by Jerry Steidem, followed by Bill Gaines.
Thank you. Good morning, Commissioners, Department, and Commission staff. Pamela Flick with Defenders of Wildlife. Now that AB 821 is law, we strongly encourage that you adopt Alternative 2, since the Department will have to enforce this regulation in historic or potential condor habitat encompassing the Southern Sierra Range. And I wonder if adoption of that alternative would preclude having to re-notice. It's a question that I had. Regarding the Commission's requirement to certify and define non-lead ammunition, I understand there's some concern about the specific language in the bill requiring that the ammunition have no lead content. In a letter to the governor from Dr. J.W. Morris, Jr., who's a professor of metallurgy at UC Berkeley, he can say with certainty, and I quote, that when a typical qualified metallurgist uses the term no lead or lead-free in reference to the composition of an alloy or parent metal, he does not mean that it is literally no trace of lead in the alloy or metal, he means that the lead content falls below some reference value, which is ordinarily set by an appropriate regulatory authority or defined by an industrial standard. And he goes on to say that professional metallurgists often refer to and use lead-free alloys in engineering applications. This is used for solder that includes less than 0.1% lead by weight, and that phrases like non-lead and lead-free are common technical terms, so I hope we don't stumble over that. Dr. Fry's letter that you've already mentioned also notes that the Safe Drinking Water Act of 1996 by Congress states that lead-free plumbing fixtures can have a maximum allowable lead content of up to 8%, which is clearly not lead-free. Is clearly up to the commission to define and certify centerfire non-lead ammunition, so it will be what you make it. It's our understanding, and Dr. Langham also pointed out, that the highest amount in tough pitch copper is 0.4% by lead by weight, where Barnes pure copper is just 5 parts per million. We're unaware of any specific studies on safe levels of trace lead levels in condors, and hope that more studies will be coming shortly. But we have looked at Dr. Fry's cursory calculations, and it's been noted that he said that less than 1% by weight would not pose a toxic threat to condors. So in order to continue the strong hunting tradition in condor country, which we feel will positively impact condor recovery once we get the lead out, it's imperative that you set the maximum lead threshold at a level that will be economically viable both for the manufacturers and the hunters. Thank you.
Pamela, I'd like to get a copy of that letter that you referred to, if there's a way that we can do that, please.
The Dr. Morris letter?
Yes, please.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, we have Mr. Jerry, I believe it's Stidham, and followed by Bill Gaines.
Good morning, commissioners. I'll be very brief. My name is Gerald Stidham, and I'm a board member of the Ventana Wildlife Society, which is the state's largest nonprofit organization involved in the hands-on release and rehabilitation of California condors. We currently have 41 condors in the wild in Big Sur and at the Pinnacles National Monument in conjunction with the National Park Service. And I'm here today to encourage the commission to adopt two things within your planned amendments, which also relate to the survival of our California condor population. First, a regulation that will provide for the lowest lead content possible in hunting ammunition. As an example, the 99.95% lead-free reference used by Barnes Copper Bullets as a guarantee would be acceptable to our organization, and we urge your support when finalizing your written dialogue. And secondly, as indicated by the Deputy Director a little earlier, the adoption of your territorial option 3B within your proposed changes, which will require the non-lead ammunition use in the historical deer hunt zones that do include D7, D8, and D9, especially since the recent legislative outcome of Assembly Bill 821 already includes such an option and uses these particular deer hunt zone wordings. I'd be happy to answer any questions on either of those issues if you might have them.
I don't have any, commissioners. Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. Bill Gaines.
Commissioners, department staff, my name is Bill Gaines. I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. It's a pleasure to be here in front of you this morning. 3 points I'd like to chat with the commission about in regards to the lead bullet ban. Number one is the need to adopt a definition of non-lead, which would allow the continued use of the current non-toxic loads that are available today. Secondly, not to expand the regulation above and beyond the species that are already called out in AB 821. And lastly, to answer Commissioner Sutton's question a little bit earlier this morning, the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance has been looking at the need to find some private funding to bring into the mix to help offset the increased cost of these loads for quite some time now. In fact, ever since this was first discussed, I believe it was down in San Diego several months ago. Regardless of whether it was 821 or commission action, whatever, if a non-lead regulation was going to be put in place in the Condor Range, we needed to find a way to help offset those costs so we can continue to get some of the less affluent hunters, and we have many of them out in the field on a continued basis. We've been working on that for quite some time, and we're pleased to say that we believe we're making some progress, not enough progress where I'm going to stand in front of you here today and say that we've got somebody that's willing to write that big check, but we're confident that we can get there, and we're more than willing to work with other hunting organizations, environmental organizations, anybody who's paying close attention to this to see to it that those dollars are brought to the table. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them now.
Bill, I believe the Department of Finance takes Visa. So, you know, I suspect this is one of these things where we're not going to need to provide funding in perpetuity. We're talking about a transition program to allow the manufacturers to ramp up, and as that happens, cost comes down. This is what happened with Steel Shot years ago, and I see no reason this would be any different. So, thanks for your willingness to explore the options.
No, and we'll continue to do so. Quickly, in regards to the cost coming down, we've had non-toxic loads required for waterfowl now for longer than I care to remember on a nationwide basis, now, of course, in Canada as well. They're still more expensive than the standard lead loads that we used to shoot many, many years ago. So I don't know if the cost will ever get down to where we need it to be, especially when you're talking about a very small footprint that this regulation applies in as opposed to the nationwide and even greater regulation that applies to waterfowl. So there'll always be a need out there to find a way to help offset those costs, but certainly that need will be greatest here in the near term. Thank you.
Any other public comment?
I want to make it very apparent for the record that that is all of the speaker cards that we have on this item, and I'm asking if there's anybody else from the public to comment on this. I see no response to that.
Okay, commissioners, your thoughts. I think staff had suggested that we need to re-notice 475, and I was just asking staff to prepare a motion or state a motion for the record of what you need from the commission today.
So I think if I'm understanding the intent of the motion, it would be to re-notice to include for the non-game birds and mammals the range specified in NAVA's bill so that you have the option in December whether or not you would like to vote on that portion. That would include a 15-day notice and tee up possible adoption in December. So that's the first part of the motion. The second part of the motion is directing department and commission staff to come to you at your February meeting with a new ISOR to deal with all of the cleanup language, we're calling it, that was not covered in NAVA's bill and was your original intent.
So the suggestions on re-noticing 475, to be very clear, just give us the option in December of what we choose to do.
Correct.
Okay. Commissioner?
So moved.
Okay. Can I have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any other actions staff needs or department needs? I really do appreciate. I know a lot of things were changing here during the meeting, and people were scurrying around trying to make sure we were clear on this. It's a very complicated issue, trying to understand the intent and the desire of the assembly or the legislature and the governor on this item, as well as dealing with our regulatory parameters. So I do appreciate everybody's efforts from the department and the staff reacting as quickly as you have to these issues.
And it'll continue to get more complicated as amendments and
yes.
new things come up.
Thank you. Okay. With that, we'll move on to item number 17. This is receipt of public testimony on proposed changes to Section 671.
Thank you. This is, as stated, this is for public testimony on Section 671 regarding importation, transportation, and possession of live restricted animals.
John, Sankey asked us to give a presentation first, the department give a short presentation.
Yeah, that would be the plan. Before you start your presentation, I wanted to indicate that we have published notice on this. The ISOR is out. It's out for public distribution. We have received some public speakers that want to speak on this, and we have some correspondence in your package. So with that, I will turn this over to the department.
So it's the B presentation?
Yeah.
Okay.
This is Susan Ellis, the department's invasive species coordinator.
I just need this one.
Great.
This one.
Okay.
Forward and back. And if you want a cursor or something,
I'm going to
watch it over there.
Okay. I think.
Hello, my name is Susan Ellis. I'm the invasive species coordinator for the Department of Fish and Game. We're going to give a short presentation on this item if I figure out how to do it. And I'm not having any luck. Oh, okay, now we went too far, way far. Can you get to the front of it? Okay. I'm going to start by giving a presentation on many of the species and the process that we use to recommend these to the commission. Scott Barrow from Fisheries Programs, Fisheries Branch, is going to finish up the presentation. I'm still not. Okay, that's all I need is a forward button. I hope not to go backwards. What we've done, and I'm going to need my glasses here, is we're recommending 8 different listings to be added to the 671 list. And what the 671 list is a restricted species list. It's not a prohibited species list. Importation, possession, and transportation of these species would be restricted unless you have a special permit, and special permits are available. We want to add these species so the department has the tools and authority to protect our native species and habitats. And also, from an economic view, we want to avoid the kind of problems that we came across at Lake Davis. You know, a species that was illegally introduced. And pike are on the restricted species list. We got them anyway, but we think this is a good way to avoid some of those costs in the future. We looked at these species, evaluated them all. We set up a questionnaire, went through the questionnaire with stakeholders and with academia to make sure we were hitting the points that we needed to in order to make these suggestions. And we also were charged with looking at climate change and whether climate change, as that occurs, whether these species would be able to establish in California. We determined with each of these that the risks outweigh any potential benefits. The first one that we just want to introduce you to very briefly is the southern water snake. There are 3 known populations in California. They are quite obnoxious snakes. They're aggressive. They're aggressive to people. They also can impact the threatened giant garter snake in Northern California. We'd like to add this to the list, and we do have proposals and grant proposals in to try to get rid of those 3 populations. The next species is a channeled apple snail. It is primarily an agricultural pest. We've worked with the Department of Food and Agriculture on this, and we'd like to see this on the list. There are 3 known populations of this in California. 2 of them are fairly isolated, and we think that we could get rid of them also. This species has been a rice pest in China and can also affect other aquatic plants. The Koki frog, many of you may have heard of or heard if you spend any time in Hawaii. It is from Puerto Rico, has been established in the Hawaiian Islands, and it's to the point in Hawaii that you cannot sell a house if you have Koki frog on your property without putting that in the notice, because they are so loud and obnoxious that people don't want to buy the property. We've had importations into California through the tropical horticulture trade. The frogs have been found in Southern California in a couple of nurseries, and we did get a report of a wild population last year. We're not sure that they can live long-term in the wild, but we want to be conservative on this. The Department of Food and Agriculture has also expressed its willingness to go into the nurseries and treat the nurseries so that Southern California so we can get rid of them. The mute swan is another species that is we're having problems with nationwide, but here in California now there is a feral population, there's a reproducing population, and we really want to make sure that these are limited, particularly around our wildlife areas. So we'd like to see this listed. A couple of species that aren't here yet. The large-scale silver carp is really a name change. It's already on the list. It's called silver carp. There was a taxonomic change, so it's a cleanup of a loophole on the list. And another species that's not here that was just recently added to the federal Lacey Act list, which is their injurious wildlife list, is the black carp. And so it cannot be imported into the state now because there's no interstate transportation, but it helps if we have it on our list also. The last thing I'm going to address is the abalone, and just very briefly, these non-native species of abalone are a way of bringing diseases, pathogens into the state, and marine resources and our pathologists really think it's important to start having some control over how these are handled and to handle any importations through restricted species permits. I'm going to turn this over to Scott. From Fisheries Branch to discuss the last species that we're recommending. It's just that one right there.
All right. Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Scott Barrow, Fisheries Branch. Can we have the presentation back up, please?
It's right here.
Well, it was it anyway.
Oh, was it?
I don't need it there. Basically, I'm here to talk about Barramundi, Lates calcifer. You find a lot of information on the internet calling it the next big fish. The question is it going to be for California or not? That's what we're trying to discuss show today. Bottom, you see a couple examples of Barramundi, the natural habitat. As you notice, those people have big smiles in their face. Why all the interest in Barramundi? Well, basically, it's an economically important species for commercial fisheries and aquaculture in the Indo-Pacific. It's a highly prized fish by the Australian sport fishery. And it's also presently farmed in Massachusetts and Europe. It's a mild white flesh similar to Chilean sea bass. Cooks the same as Chilean sea bass. That's why they call it the next big fish. It's also listed as best choice for sustainable seafood by the Seafood Watch if farmed in U.S. enclosed systems. A little brief about the biology. It's a catadromous species found in the Indo-Pacific and coastal rivers, estuaries, and lagoons. Basically, it lives in freshwater and spawns in saltwater. It's a hermaphroditic species. Most mature as males at 3 to 5 years, and then after one spawning become females, though there are a few that mature directly to females, and there are a few males that never change. Temperature range. It's 59 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. In the wild, it runs about 59 to 82 degrees Fahrenheit. Aquaculture runs about 68 degrees to 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So there is a little overlap there. Common length, 4 feet. Max length, 6.6 feet. Weight, common weight, 1 to 13 pounds. Max weight, 132 pounds. Growth rate is highly variable. Normally, under optimal conditions, it can grow 1 foot in the first year. Picture says 1,000 words. Why are we concerned? It's a nocturnal species caught in Australia at night. And you see, that's what we're concerned about. Another introduced species getting loose. The original basis for adding to 671, wide temperature range. Most of that range will cover most of California. As global warming increases the temperature in California, who knows what effects it's going to have on our native populations. It's urehaline, can live in freshwater, brackish water, or seawater, carries the encephalitis virus, also known as the notovirus, or viral nervous necrosis is the official name for it. It's very difficult to identify. can be transmitted to other fish species not presently found in California inland waters. It's a very aggressive predator and is highly prized by anglers. And it's also our past experience with uncontrolled non-native species introductions, such as pike, tilapia, alligator gar, and numerous others. So that's why we want to add to 671. Some additional information that has come up as I continue researching this issue is that the Indo-native fish are under threat of this virus due to escapees from infected farms. Barramundi and tilapia have a similar temperature range and possible habitat adaptability. And also we found that tilapia are more tolerant of cold temperatures than originally thought. We've also found tilapia, pacu, that's a species that looks like piranha, and other warm water species living in California with varied success. Also, surprisingly, Seafood Watch also lists high risk to wild stocks from barramundi survivors if they happen to escape the farms and natural environment. So what is the purpose? Why do we want it on 671? Basically, we want to provide the department with additional authority to provide additional permit requirements under 671.1, a restricted species permit, so that we can continue to control and monitor these non-native species of special concern as they are asked to be imported into California. That'll give us additional monitoring of aquaculture, live terminal market, pet, hobby, importation, distribution concerning these species. Presently right now, Fish and Game Code allows mollusks and crustaceans that are not going to be placed in state waters, or pet, private, or ornamental fish and plants that are going to be kept within an aquarium and not placed in state waters or not sold for food and bait to come in without any permit. As we have seen with the other species, they eventually get out some way, some shape, some form. Why is this additional authority needed? An intentional release into the state waters, disease transmission to native fish species, this viral nervous necrosis is not well understood how it transfers from wild to native stocks or from fish to fish, and also basically our past experience with non-native species. So basically the question we're struggling with is how do we get the product above without getting its resultant product in the natural environment below. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you. Commissioner Sutton.
Great presentation. Thank you. Very well done and organized. I can certainly appreciate the department's position on barramundi and tilapia, for that matter. Your primary concern, I appreciate the paper that was included, the background paper and the materials as well. The primary concern seems to be twofold, disease transmission and exotic species introductions. These are legitimate concerns, obviously not confined to barramundi. As you alluded, we have a similar problem with tilapia, which I understand is not currently on the list either. Here is my dilemma, and maybe we can address this last question you posed. Aquaculture is growing exponentially in this country and around the world. Many types of aquaculture have serious environmental impacts, including the ones that you've mentioned here. Now, closed containment systems seem to be among the best ways to grow seafood and avoid environmental impacts and disease transmission. These systems are well proven. We operate a number of them ourselves in Monterey. Biosafety protocols are built into these systems, or they shouldn't be permitted by the commission or anybody else in California. Now, if we ban barramundi aquaculture in California, we're going to have to ban tilapia aquaculture and all similar species, even if they're grown in state-of-the-art closed systems in the desert. Personally, I hope we can do better than that with adaptive management here. I think we can manage this on a little finer scale than perhaps we've proposed. I think our management systems are such that we can safely, and technology is such that we can safely avoid escapes and disease transmission from these facilities. Now, you both have made the point this morning that what we're proposing here is not a ban on import of these species. They can still be imported by permit. So I guess my question is, given your experience, your feelings now about this species and others like tilapia, would the department issue permits for barramundi aquaculture if it was added to the list?
Yeah. I was going to point out, there has been some confusion. The addition of the species to 671 does not prohibit the department or an aquaculturist from having barramundi. And the department, and I don't know if Scott has the detail, but the department has in regulation and in policy some very specific biosecurity criteria for an aquaculture facility wanting to get a permit to raise one of these restricted species. That's already in place. It's applied to your transgenic species. A while ago, the commission authorized transgenic fish, and those permits require very specific biosecurity measures. And it's typically no contact with state waters. They might have to leave dead, for example, no live transportation. You don't want a tanker truck tipping over into the Sacramento River with 20,000 fish. So, yes, I want to make it clear, this putting it on this list does not in itself restrict. And the department looks at every aquaculture permit request from the ground up. And we don't have a problem in the appropriate facility and operation from this fish. It's a highly valued fish. The department also is, by its statute, and it applies to the commission too, is required and obliged to support aquaculture that doesn't impact our natural resources. So the answer is yes. If we see an applicant and an operation that we feel has the appropriate security measures, it being on this list does not prevent us from issuing that permit.
Thanks for that clarification, Sankey. We're dealing here with sort of a classic conflict between two, tension between two sort of conflicting mandates positions. One is that is our desire to promote sustainable aquaculture. The other is our desire to avoid these exotic species introductions and disease transmission and so forth, both of which are legitimate. But I just want to make sure we navigate that carefully so that we don't, you know, take such a strong position on one that we foreclose the other unnecessarily. And so it's good to hear that, you know, that would still be technically possible. Just a clarification question, Sankey. Do you think we would need to issue two permits? We would need first to, if say somebody wants to start a barramundi farm in Southern California, we need to issue an importation permit first, and then the commission would have to issue an aquaculture permit?
I'd let Scott attempt to answer that one. I'm not sure the specific process.
That's a part we're struggling with, and we would have come to you with some more information on that. We have some ideas, draft ideas, but the commission hasn't approved that at this point. And I want to remind that the tilapia is on the restricted species list, and we don't allow it north of Tehachapi. So, and we are, I believe, we're using those just a regular importation permit to process those. So that there's a couple avenues to approach, and we're just trying to struggle with this if the commission decides to go the next step beyond this.
Okay. Commissioner Kellogg, did you have a comment?
Just that I think the department's on the right track. There's a right way and a wrong way to do it, and they're going to define it.
Anki, did you have something else?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure. The department does, in fact, support aquaculture. We just want to make sure it's done responsibly, and that's all we're asking. And, again, the 671 is a tool. It prevents just indiscriminate importation of these things, which I hope we've made a case. There's some huge risk at that, and we don't want to repeat the pike effort. I can't afford another one of those.
What was the budget on that pike eradication?
Frightening.
Yes.
But let's be real about that. No regulation is going to forestall the illegal, clandestine introduction of a species like pike. Pike was on the list when it was introduced, wasn't it?
Right. And you make a good point. Part of the reason we part of it is an outreach. We don't even want people to love this fish because that causes an unfortunate behavior sometime, like the pike. And so that's one of the reasons we have concerns about certain pet trades or shows trying to encourage ownership of some of these things. We have a lot of work to do there on an outreach side, discouraging ownership of things people shouldn't own, because it just promotes unfortunate behavior, and that's part of this.
Well, see, we only can control what we can control. I mean, nobody allowed anybody to put pike in Lake David.
Absolutely.
They found 2 4-foot alligators in the Delta this year. I mean, we didn't allow that. So you only can control what you control.
But we have to be responsible, and I think that the species that they've suggested appear to me to be species that have been thought through, that the restriction is appropriate. But let's hear
I want to hear public comment as well. Just one last suggestion while I'm thinking of it. Clearly, the state of Massachusetts has gone through a similar analysis, because they have a big barramundi farm in the mountains of Massachusetts, presumably in a lot closer proximity to rivers than we would in Southern California. It would be interesting to talk to them to know, and I haven't done that, to know what their experience has been with this, and whether these farms have appropriate safety protocols in place.
Okay, let's take some public comment then.
Okay, before we take public comment, I want to call your attention to 3 handouts that came in regarding this item from Mr. Joseph Sincotta, from the Department of Food and Agriculture, and from Dr. Rick Staub. And again, these were submitted in your meeting handouts correspondence after the binders were prepared. We have 4 public speakers on this item. You'll each get 3 minutes. Mr. Mark Drawbridge, followed by Mr. H. Roy Gordon, followed by Mark Eglinton.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Commission staff, and members of the Department, thank you for giving me an opportunity to comment on this important issue, especially as it relates to barramundi. My name is Mark Drawbridge, and I'm the President of the California Aquaculture Association. Outside of the California Aquaculture Association, I'm a senior research scientist for Hub SeaWorld Research Institute, where I direct our marine finfish aquaculture program. I've been involved in marine aquaculture research for nearly 20 years. As it relates to today's discussion of barramundi, as a little additional background for you, I would mention that I spent a year of study at the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia, which is when I was first introduced to barramundi as Australia's premier culture species. Subsequently, through my participation in the World Aquaculture Society's International Working Group on Stock Enhancement and Sea Ranching, I've developed a personal working relationship with leading experts in barramundi culture within the Australian government. Finally, I will be providing the Commission a copy of a paper that I co-authored with an international team of experts, including Ron Hedrick of UC Davis, on the first reported case of nodovirus in North America, which we reported among our white sea bass in San Diego in 2001, with a history that dates back to 1992. I'm obviously going to run out of time in this presentation. I would hope that the Commission would feel free to ask me any questions about my experience in those areas at the end of my testimony. My testimony today is going to focus on 3 primary areas of concern to CAA's membership that stem collectively from Commission meetings held since February, when the topic of barramundi was most recently introduced in a permit application, by Mr. Eglinton of Blue Beyond Fisheries. I'm going to preface my testimony and reinforce it subsequently by stating that we believe that many of our concerns, and some of those have been shared this morning already, have arisen from a void left by the Department's aquaculture coordinator, Bob Holbrook, who retired last December. We believe that it's critically important that a new aquaculture coordinator be appointed as soon as possible, so we can begin to make up some lost ground that is continuing to grow and clear up some of the confusion that Sankey has alluded to. The first concern I want to address can perhaps be best expressed by quoting directly from President Rogers at the Commission meeting last February, at which time he stated, "If we are going to think that aquaculture is an important part of the economy and a food source for the state of California, then this seems to be a reasonable way to do it." The big question our membership has, and I heard some positive reinforcement here today, is do we collectively think that aquaculture is going to play an important role in those areas within California? Obviously, to the California Aquaculture Association, that answer is very simple. However, our membership is deeply concerned that the recent viewpoints and actions expressed by the commissions in the department do not support a unified vision of the current and future importance of aquaculture to the state. Some of the examples of this concern will be evident in the rest of my testimony. I'm not going to dwell on it here. We'd rather move forward. Again, I want to reiterate the fact, though, that we do need to get an aquaculture coordinator on board so we can foster multi-directional communication and help address these legitimate concerns through sound science. The second area of concern I'd like to...
Mark, you need to wrap up, and I just want to make sure that we're correct for the record here. This item is on these restricted species, not on the whole issue of aquaculture. So I understand. I'm understanding your
right.
comments to mean that
okay.
you'd like us to bring back and discuss the aquaculture policy. But under this right now, we're taking comment on the 671 regs and how
right.
they might affect it, I guess.
Well, I guess the only point I would make relative to discussions we've already had this morning is I believe that these issues are interwoven. We've already had, in February, a permit application was brought before the commission and it was denied. So that is of concern to our membership relative to some of the conversations that just went on, because it seems like that has simultaneously kicked off some of the conversations here. So I believe it's very relevant. I will wrap up. I will provide my testimony in written format because I do have some very important points I do want to make. In terms of concluding, we need to remove some of the cloudiness that is arising relative to these issues. Mr. Sutton brought up a lot of this, and we do need to clear the path. It seems like the rules of the game are changing. Our membership just wants to understand what those rules are. We also do want to be a part of that process. We believe that the information provided at the February meeting where the permit application was denied was wholly inadequate to make the decision that was made at that time. After reviewing the presentation we saw here, I still think the information is lacking. I just want to highlight a couple points on that. The first one is we have applied, in the case of Barramundi, kind of a one-size-fits-all description of its ecological requirements. The reality is it's a tropical species. It requires water temperature above 26 degrees to spawn. We need to look at each life stage and the habitat environmental conditions required for its longevity if it is to establish itself in California. Secondly, I have personal experience. The department has personal experience. UC Davis has personal experience with notoviruses in fish in California. I have not seen that brought to the table yet. Ron Hedrick and Dr. Mark Okihiro on the department staff, I would argue, are leading experts in the country on notoviruses. I would like to have their opinions heard and brought forward in this. In conclusion, we want to state that the information provided to date is inadequate, in our opinion, to restrict Barramundi from the state. We would urge the commission to remove Barramundi from the current list of proposed species until a much more thorough review can be developed. Along these lines, the department has at its disposal an aquaculture development committee, aquaculture disease committee, and an aquaculture coordinator, all designated by law to help deal
Thank
with
you.
Precisely these types of issues.
Mark, we've really exceeded
okay.
our time here.
Okay.
I apologize, but we do need to give everyone
right.
an opportunity.
That's all I'll say. Thank you.
Okay.
And I would reiterate that I'm here to answer any questions you may
Great.
Have.
Great. Thank you. And you are going to submit your comments in writing to us. I do suppose that at least one commissioner and the MRC will be looking at this issue in more depth. And I understand your concerns, but we are taking comment on the restricted species. And I heard at the final end there that you're asking us not to restrict
That's
right. Barramundi.
Thank
okay.
you for your time.
Thank you.
Mr. H. Roy Gordon, followed by Mark Eglinton, followed by Anthony M. Schur.
Good morning, commissioners, staff, members of the department. I'm Roy Gordon. I'm on the department's Aquaculture Disease Committee, Aquaculture Development Committee. I'm an advisor to the California Aquaculture Association. And through my company, Fish Tech, Inc., I'm an advisor to wild fisheries as well as aquaculture in most of the many places in the world. The subject is Barramundi. I have three brief points to make. The first is that in the notice of change of regulations, the preparers have determined that the proposed action will not have a significant statewide adverse economic impact directly affecting business, including the ability of California businesses to compete with businesses in other states. This assumption is not correct in the case of Barramundi. California aquaculture could be eliminated from the opportunity to compete with major Barramundi operations in aquaculture, both current and planned in eastern and western U.S. Just one farm in Massachusetts will produce 1,000 tons. There are many others. 1,000 tons, which is nearly 5% of the total finfish production, not shellfish, but finfish production in California. No significant impact on California businesses to compete with businesses in other states? I don't understand. Second point is with reference to the specific and current case. An application letter to the department by Blue Beyond Fisheries, dated November 3rd, 2006, gives clear and specific reasons why the proposed barramundi production will not pose a threat to the native fisheries. Specifically, no wastewater leaves the farm, and there are no bodies of water within several miles, and furthermore, that all fish will be euthanized before shipping to markets, and no live barramundi will leave the farm without authorization from the department. Live fish cannot escape from the proposed facility. In pathologist terms, this is a terminal facility. The department should approve this aquaculture application with appropriate restrictions. And I believe strongly that had an aquaculture coordinator been in place instead of one just exiting back in November, that we wouldn't be dealing with this case right now. It would have been approved. Lastly, on barramundi, the department issue paper for the hearing, for this hearing, states that the department continues to be concerned about lack of information on barramundi, its temperature range, et cetera. I'm almost finished. Many scientists feel strongly that the information is already in hand, that barramundi is unable to reproduce in any of the conditions of any of California's waters. We request to the commission postpone the listing of barramundi until an aquaculture coordinator is on board and able to assist in developing additional scientific consensus. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Eglinton, followed by Anthony Schur.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Mark Eglinton from Blue Beyond Fisheries. A couple of points. Firstly, Nevada now has one current location producing barramundi, and another one is in being built currently. So that would put three in this country at this stage with more planned. Zonke mentioned that, as with regards to an application, that if the fish were supplied dead to the market, and there was no access to state waters, okay, i.e. a terminal facility, then there's no reason why they wouldn't approve my application. Well, my application in February, I had a PowerPoint presentation that showed that and significantly more, also with the ways that we treat water, everything like that. I have no idea why I got denied then, other than the misinformation about the viruses and making it sound like there's some sort of a sensational idea that no virus is going to destroy California when it already exists here. And then they come up with another virus as well and state that it's virtually never found in Southern California, which means it is found. Which then says to me that I actually have to protect my fish that I would grow with no virus from California waters, not the other way around. This would be the barramundi. If you consider the fact that now all of a sudden they're trying to bring the fish to the same level as tilapia, they're saying that it has the same kind of habitat adaptability and similar temperature range. It's a tropical fish. There are millions of different types of fish that live in tropical regions that all live in the same temperature range. So why suddenly bring in tilapia? It's got nothing to do with it. Tilapia become mature at 3 months. Their population can double within 6 months. Barramundi takes 5 years before they're mature, 3 to 5 years. Then they need the adaptation to female. And there's a massive difference in the way these things reproduce. It's got nothing to do with one, doesn't have anything to do with the other. Then also, they didn't include in the fact that the temperature range specific for the growth of the larvae and for spawning is 26 to 28 degrees. And there's no argument there. This is nature determining the survival of something. And that's the reason why they produce so many eggs, because the survival rate is so low. They need monsoons to trigger the movement of the males from the headwaters, freshwater, down to estuarine, which is mangrove areas, okay, which is brackish. Well, we don't have monsoons. India has monsoons. Australia has monsoons. We don't have any monsoons. So a lot of the methods that they've used here to be able to prove that Barramundi is this, you know, big bad fish are totally irrelevant and not confirmed. And I don't understand why my application was denied, other than the fact that it was misinformation. And if Zonkey is correct, then there's no reason why I shouldn't receive an approval immediately. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Again, I'd like to ask the public to comment on the 671 eyesore. Those are the comments that we should be receiving today. This isn't a rehearing of a previous issue. At this point, it may be in the future, but not at this point.
The last speaker card I have on this is for Anthony M. Schur.
Good morning. My name is Tony Schur. I'm an aquaculture consultant. I do bioengineering work in California. I have for the past 35, perhaps even 37 years, done that sort of work, both in California and internationally. Most of my work is now international. I have to say that it's international because the opportunities to conduct aquaculture in California are actually shrinking, not expanding. And this is one of the reasons why. I have to say, I'm trying to justify this discussion about aquaculture, Madam Chairman, is that there's a much broader implication about Barramundi for us. We have to produce new species that satisfy markets. I have to say, it's unfortunate I have to say it, but I find it disingenuous to suggest that the position of the Barramundi on the restricted list and the rejection of Mark's application are not related. I think the department has a policy, and I think we've heard it over and over again within meetings, even in the 671 process, that they want no additional exotic species in California under any circumstances, no how. I can say the quote. I can repeat the quote. If we don't have it now, we don't want it. We have heard high-level staff say exactly those words. So I'm sorry to bring this up at this level, but we have to look at this as openly hostile to our existence and misguided. It's peculiar that this is the case in a state where most all of our major sport fish, almost all of our aquaculture species, are indeed introduced species. We don't look at them as such, but catfish, black bass, and hybrid striped bass are all introduced species that are absorbed in our economy and in our systems quite readily. I'll go on. If aquaculture production does not increase in the United States and in California, where it is indeed shrinking, our seafood dollars will continue to finance the collapse of global fisheries that are threatened by overexploitation. Aquaculture is driven by the incentive to provide clients with seafood, the seafood that they want. We would love to give people in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills the same opportunity as their colleagues in Boston who can have Barramundi. We think we can do that. We think we can do it safely. We think we can do it environmentally, in an environmentally sound way. I'll just stop right there, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to field them.
Commissioners, any questions? I don't think we do. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Sankey?
I'd like to, since they're quoting me, I think, I'd like to kind of clarify. I think they're confusing a desire and a simplicity with reality. I mean, clearly, if asked, would the department want all these exotics? No, we do not want exotics. It makes a nightmare to manage our natural resource. That's fundamental. However, that's being misconstrued, I think, that we're somehow opposed to aquaculture in any way. We support aquaculture. We always have. I can't speak to the permit appeal. We'll gladly revisit that. I don't have a problem revisiting the gentleman's application. But I think we need to make clear 671 is strictly about, it's actually logically backwards. Technically, that list should be everything that's not native is not allowed unless you're allowed to have it. Unfortunately, right. The way that law was generated, it's backwards logically. So given that, we come across species when it's brought to our attention that for whatever reason present a risk in our view, and we assess, as Scott tried to point out, is this a serious risk versus the hassles, et cetera. We believe this fish, because it is such a wonderful fish, does in fact have tolerances that it could escape in California and impact some of our systems. Because of that, we think it should be on 671. But that does not in any way mean that we're opposed to using it as an aquaculture fish. That's a different process. 671 does not prohibit it. Aquaculturalists have to apply for a permit, whatever species they ask for. So that's, they are connected, true, but it does not in any way prohibit aquaculture. And again, I can't speak to the gentleman's application, but we're more than willing to relook at it. Part of our reaction initially may have been because there was it was an open door to Barramundi,
right.
But I'm familiar with the specific case, but that's my view at least.
Sankey, would it be appropriate if the other commissioners agree to have a larger discussion on aquaculture in general, looking at what we charge in fees for enforcement? I mean, I have a lot of concerns about what it would take to regulate this and who pays the cost of that in a time when we have our natural resources to protect, not necessarily other species, and instead of looking at just this gentleman's appeal, which I'm more than happy to have the department look at as well, but I'd like to have the broader discussion on aquaculture, and I think many of our questions might be answered at that point. We can develop some policies and some thoughts on the broader issue so that each permittee isn't bearing the burden of convincing the commission on some issues that maybe the department and the commission can work together on. Does that make sense to you, Mike?
That makes particular sense to me in light of the new legislation in California on governing aquaculture in general. It's a new ball game we're dealing with. Let me just propose, we have three options here, it seems to me, with respect to Section 671. One is to proceed with the rulemaking as proposed by the department. The second option is to proceed with the rulemaking but remove Barramundi from the proposal. The third option would be to proceed with the rulemaking including Barramundi but ask the department to develop a series of conditions or requirements under which they would permit the import and farming of this species so as to make it clear to everybody what the hoops they would have to jump through in order to qualify for an import and aquaculture permit for this species.
Well, I guess what you're suggesting is that we take this different than some of the other species on our list and treat it differently. I'm not willing to do that at this point. I mean, I think 671 needs to stand alone, but I do agree with needing to hold a policy development session on aquaculture in general. But I, at least as one commissioner, I would not be supportive of treating Barramundi. If the department has shown us that they think this is a threat, there needs to be special restrictions on it and permits required, then I'm in agreement with the department on that. We don't have to take action today. It's certainly noticed, and I understand what you're asking for, and I'll defer to Commissioner Kellogg on that.
Well, I pretty much agree with your comments. At this point, I'm in favor of approving the recommendation of the department to Change 671 the way they recommend.
Well, yeah, this is not our adoption hearing.
No, I know. I'm just letting you know where I'm at this point.
Perhaps, Sankey, at the next...
I'm open to those discussions on aquaculture as well.
The December meeting, could you talk a little bit more and maybe bring us a briefing on what the permit requirements might be? on a separate discussion item. I'm not sure that it's appropriate here under 671, or if I'm incorrect.
The good news, we already have standards that we apply. So I think it's an excellent idea. I mean, aquaculture, as the gentleman said, it is a growing industry, or could be growing, and probably should be given the world's food requirements. And the department has a long relationship with the aquaculture industry, not only our pathology folks who work very closely with them to make sure they have facilities that are healthy, fish that are healthy. I think it'd be good to review your current regulations and policies. You have quite a few, actually. And we could come prepared in December on a separate informational item, kind of a review of aquaculture. And then, of course, the industry, I mean, it's not a perfect system. In one of the areas we got to work on, actually, is some cleanup. But I think that would be a great venue.
Well,
I
appreciate your willingness to do it in December. I do think we have a heavy agenda in December. And I'm almost considering that this might be a special half-day workshop or something
sure.
along those lines,
because
it seems like it takes a lengthier... Yeah, so... Right, but I don't... Again, I guess I'm trying to understand, Commissioner Sutton, your request would be to somehow change 671 differently for Barramundi than any other of the restrictions?
Not necessarily. I think what I'd like to see, really, from the department is how they would operationally... treat the relationship between the aquaculture permitting process and the 671 permitting process. Ideally, I guess, when you're dealing with a species on the list that's subject to aquaculture, you would have a permit system that would take into account both of these sections.
Yes.
In the same
and
process.
We could do that for you as an example.
Okay.
We probably could give you several examples. So the idea is that December, we would give you a little briefing on how an applicant for Barramundi, if it was listed, would be handled and how a person would go through the process.
Presumably that would apply to tilapia.
Yeah, it would apply to anything on the restricted species list.
Good.
We will do that.
Okay. Thank you for your comments today. Appreciate it. And I think we'll look forward to maybe sometime, let's look at our agendas for next year and schedule. I don't know if it'll be a special meeting or a longer meeting, but let's talk about how much time we might need for that agenda item. It might be outside our regular meeting schedule.
If you recall our discussion yesterday on the Marine Advisory, the Marine Resources Committee, this subject in general, aquaculture, is we flagged as an informational issue for the MRC, and we might be able to deal with it there in that context.
Thank you, Mike.
Okay, so let me summarize to make sure I understand this correct. We are scheduled to adopt regulations regarding 671 for the December meeting. There may be a broader discussion of aquaculture at the December meeting or at some other meeting in the future. Is that what I'm hearing?
I guess I'm going to suggest, because we also have some other lengthy items on the December agenda, that we not try to discuss aquaculture at that meeting in general, that we look for after the first of the year and put it on an agenda.
Okay, fine. So it'll be outside after December.
Yeah, I don't want people to feel they need to come on aquaculture that meeting.
Okay.
We have many other items that meeting as far as I'm looking at. Okay, so we'll move on now to consent calendar. I do believe there's a desire to pull item number 19.
Yes, the department is requesting to pull item 19 from the consent calendar, and I believe that's it for the consent calendar to be pulled.
Okay. Do I have a motion for the remaining items on the consent calendar?
I'll move the consent calendar with the exception of item 19.
Do I have a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, we'll move on to item 19 then.
Okay, number 19 is proposed adoption of proposed changes to Section 630, Title 14, regarding ecological reserves. Deputy Director Sankey Mastrup, would you want to speak to that, or do you want to introduce Dr. Loft?
Yeah, I'll let Dr. Loft of the Wildlife Programs Branch explain why we're asking for a change. Isn't this the airplane issue?
Is that what this is?
Yes.
The airplane issue.
Sorry, Eric.
And hot air balloons.
Helpful
and gliders and helicopters.
Yeah, commissioners, good morning. Chairman Gustafson, and all folks. The issue of airplanes, there was never the intent of the department to try to restrict the airspace for airplanes over our ecological reserves. We did get a letter from airplane organizations. I don't remember exactly the number, the name of the organization now offhand, but we would...
Aircraft Owners Association. Of which some of us at least are members.
Very much appreciated. I remember that when this came in, the first thought was, oh, we didn't mean to do that. And so that's why we would ask to pull this this particular issue off and then try to come back later for ecological reserves and wildlife areas with the specific recommendation for what we are trying to restrict the use of in, on our eco-reserves. So that's it in a real simple nutshell.
I'm glad that you flagged this, Eric. I was going to bring this up if the department hadn't pulled it off the consent calendar, because the current language is just too vague to pass the federal preemption test, as our council has pointed out. It's worth noting that the state can restrict low-flying aircraft. You know, we do that on the coast over state parks, for example. The federal government does it as well under natural resource protection. So I look forward to seeing what you come up with.
I apologize for not anticipating and knowing that this was going to be on here today.
As a point of clarification, you could move forward with adoption of all of those sections and go with the no change option for section 17. So you could accomplish that today, and then the department could bring that particular section back at a later time.
Yes.
Dealing with aircraft.
Okay. Yes.
Do I have a motion to that effect?
That motion, I want to make sure that our staff's okay with that. And I think they are, aren't they? Yes. They're nodding their head saying it is definitely okay to do what Deputy Director Shea just said.
Okay. So, commissioners? Do we have a motion?
I'm going to let the aircraft guy make it.
The pilot make it.
So moved with the exception of the section pertaining to aircraft.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
I think we have one item left, which is future meetings. Staff is proceeding, making efforts to schedule for future meetings, and I just wanted to inform you, we'll give you more information on this later, that we are having some difficulty with finding a place to stay in San Diego because of the recent fires. So I don't know how that's going to shape up. We have a meeting room. At this point in time, lodging is a little bit of a challenge. We'll give you an update on that in December, if that's okay.
Great. Any other items for discussion? We have. Okay, then we'll adjourn the meeting. Thank you very much. Do I need a motion for that? Okay, a motion for adjournment.
So moved. Second.
All in favor? Thank you.